Okay, I'll read Ezra. Shall I read from verse 4? I think we probably covered the first three verses fairly thoroughly, but we can go back to them again if need be. It's Cyrus, the king of Persia, who's speaking, and he's already announced that he's saying that those among the people of Judah who would go back to Jerusalem, that they may do so. And now in verse 4 he says, "And whosoever remaineth in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver and with gold and with goods and with beasts, beside the free will offering for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. Then rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, with all them whose spirit God had raised, to go up to build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. And all they that were about them strengthened their hands with vessels of silver and with gold, with goods and with beasts and with precious things, beside all that was willingly offered. Also Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem, and had put them in the house of his gods. Even those did Cyrus, king of Persia, bring forth by the hand of Mitredath, the treasurer, and numbered them in unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And this is the number of them: 30 chargers of gold, 1,000 chargers of silver, 29 knives, 30 basins of gold, silver basins of a second sort, 410, and other vessels, 1,000. All the vessels of gold and of silver were 5,400. All these did Sheshbazzar bring up with them of the captivity that were brought up from Babylon unto Jerusalem."
Just to recap where we are so far, we noted last time that Ezra, to put it in its historical context, is a continuation of the book of Second Chronicles. We say this because the last, I think, three verses of Second Chronicles are identical or almost identical with the first few verses of Ezra. The people had been in the land for many years, had been disobedient. Yes, God gave revivals from time to time, but generally speaking, the people were rebellious. And eventually, after much pleading, God sending prophet after prophet and long suffering, God finally brought in the Babylonians, and the people of Israel were removed to Babylon. Now in the book of Ezra, after 70 years in captivity, the people were to return to the land, or at least a remnant were. But what a contrast we noted last week to God bringing up his people Israel out of Egypt into the land that he had promised to give them, commencing with mighty miracles, not only in Egypt, but crossing the Red Sea, sustained miraculously through the wilderness, brought into the land again with mighty miracle, the parting of the Jordan, the walls of Jericho falling down. What a contrast to this return, where we have no miracles in these books. We also took account of this character of this book, in that God is no longer acting directly and openly for his people. When God gave Israel into the hands of the Babylonians and declared this day, which still exists today, the times of the Gentiles, Israel were declared, "Lo am I, not my people." And consequently, when the people returned, this state of things had not changed. Israel was still outwardly not God's people. At least God would not publicly own them as such. And so, although God is caring for his people, he stirred up Cyrus, he stirred up the spirits for those returned, he is acting providentially throughout the book. And the first person who is stirred up, or the first one, is not the remnant to go back, but a Gentile king, one who was named by Isaiah about 200 years before. And so God is now acting behind the scenes for his people. There's no outward public manifestation of his glory with these miracles as there was previously. And so this is how the book starts. Cyrus the king of Persia making his proclamation that we looked at last week, or 2 weeks ago, rather. And throughout this book, we'll be looking at this remnant, and we want to learn what characterizes this remnant, because we live in very similar days today. We did briefly compare it to the history of the church, looking at the seven churches. At the Reformation, God acted and brought a remnant out and restored to them in grace the truth of the gospel, and the truth of the assembly was recovered subsequent to that. But these people who desire to remain faithful to these things form a remnant, because generally speaking, they are only a small company. And so this is what we want to look at. And last time we suppose learned the first feature of a remnant. They are not the whole nation. They're only a small fraction, although they represent the whole. And where we come now, where we start today, we are really looking at the relationship between this remnant and those who did not return. How do these people respond? Well, they might not be going back, but they are encouraged to offer support. And the remnant, how do they view those who don't go back? Do they look down on them? Do they despise them? Do they criticize them? No. We see here the remnant were very happy to receive the support. They welcomed the support of those who didn't go back. They didn't despise them. I think it even goes as far as say they were strengthened by them. Mm. In verse 6, all they that were about them strengthened their hands. They didn't ignore them, say, we don't want your help. They accepted it. So this is the next point we're looking at, the remnant. Now, the relationship between those who went back and those who didn't. And although the rest of the book will take up just those who went back, yet we really want to concentrate now and see how this remnant viewed those who didn't. Because again, this should influence the way we look and deal with all believers in our day, whether they seek to gather according to the divinely appointed way, which is at Jerusalem, which is another point we discussed last week, the fact that they couldn't worship in Babylon, they could only worship in Jerusalem. But how do these people who have gone back, how do they relate to those who didn't? How do we relate to those, as we sometimes say, in the systems, those who are in places where God's order is not maintained? We desire to practice God's order. We certainly should never claim to be the people of God. We should never claim to be faithful and others not. No, if God has not revealed these things, everyone is responsible to God individually. But how do we relate to other believers? That's really the question we should answer now in these verses we start with, verses 4, 5 and 6.
Verse 5, then rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin. Of course, this points to the fact that the people who were captives in Babylon and had also inhabited the land of the Persians, because by now Babylon has ceased to be an empire, has been superseded by Persia. Cyrus was king of Persia, as we can see. It says of people of Judah and Benjamin wasn't actually all the tribes of Israel, because we know that other 10 tribes that had land in Canaan had been allotted areas in Canaan. They had gone into captivity to a different power from the Babylonians. That had been the Assyrians. But during the course of the time that there were the two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, and the two southern tribes, Judah, called here Judah and Benjamin, and the people generally referred to as Jews, there had been times, I think particularly under Hezekiah, when people from those 10 northern tribes had gone to Judah to live, because I think they were concerned about the position of the 10 northern tribes under a false religion instituted by King Jeroboam right at the beginning of the history of the 10 tribes. It's interesting to see that those who were chief men and fathers, those who could be called the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, they took responsibility to respond to this invitation of Cyrus to go to Jerusalem in Judah. So we have to, in a way, balance verse 5 with verse 4, where Cyrus seems to accept that there will be many who won't return. Whosoever remaineth in any place where he sojourneth, they were encouraged by him to provide resources for those who did go up. But I'm just wanting to point out that the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, they did seem to take an initiative. They did seem to respond in a positive way to this opportunity to go back to Jerusalem, which is, I think, a good example for us. There were those who were older, perhaps we could say, who had influence among the people of Judah, and they did seem to exercise that responsibility by rising up and perhaps encouraging others to come with them there. I don't know whether they all did it, but the way the scripture puts it in verse 5, it seems as if they did generally take that responsibility. The older ones, the chief ones, the ones who had a certain position amongst the people of God. So I think that's a good example for us.
Not wanting to go back, but Cyrus evidently had some knowledge of God.
Yes.
Because he refers to him as Jehovah, the Lord. And also, this expression, God of heaven or the God of the heavens, is very characteristic of this period, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar. The point I'm wanting to point out is that the times of the Gentiles are still running on. We're living in the times of the Gentiles. The Lord in Luke 21 says, Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And we know that is when the stone cut out without hands smites the image. So essentially, in regard to what's going on in the Middle East at the present time, Israel holds their land really under the suzerainty. It's really through Gentiles. Or if we want to say it in one word, America, that's used of God to preserve the nation in some sort. And the times of the Gentiles, this period which has begun and was continuing under the Medes and Persians in Ezra, going right back to Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, we're still during that time, and that will take us right through to the Lord's coming in power. That just as an aside, but going back to what you were saying, Simon, it's interesting that it's those whose spirit God had raised up. It's not the spirit of God that's mentioned here. It's our spirits.
The two things
work together, of course, because we're subject to divine influences, as these people were here. But isn't it true that for any revival or recovery, it starts individually and it starts internally? I mean to say, we've connected Ezra in some sense with the Reformation, the Great Recovery. Henry VIII was in dispute with the Pope because he wanted to divorce his wife. You know, that was the external thing. That was the stage, the political stage, so to speak. But God was working in the hearts of men such as Tyndale and later Cranmer and some of these early reformers who lost their lives. And there was a true work of the Spirit of God in the hearts of Luther and his contemporaries in Germany, and Calvin in Geneva, and amongst the believers in France, and in Zurich with Zwingli. And I mean, in the political stage, the German princes, you know, they wanted a certain amount of freedom from the authority of Charles V and the Holy Roman Empire. So there were all these events, providential events, we might say, just as we see providential events here with Cyrus. But nevertheless, it's those whose spirit moved them. And this shows us that revival begins with our hearts. It begins internally. It begins with our communion with God, our fellowship, our exercise before God. Spirit moved them. Just as with Gideon, you know, when he threshed wheat in secret, that was the individual there, something being worked out that would work out in deliverance from the various enemies under the time of the judges. So it's good to see that God was working here, and it's good to see that God still works today in hearts, and I suppose that's why some of us are together tonight.
Also, we see the way that God overruled at this time, because Jerusalem was completely devastated, the temple, and yet there had to be that platform for the Lord Jesus to come. I know it was several hundred years after this, but there, the temple was begun, so that when he came, there was that temple, there was the city, and there was that platform for him to come back to his people again. Well, of course, as you say, they were still under the Roman authority at that time.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, Brian, that the whole purpose, really, of these people going back was that there might be the people of God. I'm talking here, of course, about the earthly people of God, to receive him when he came back according to God's promise. Sorry, not came back. When he came, God had promised one who would visit his people. And there needed to be people in Jerusalem for him to visit. But it really shows that God honored his promise. And even despite the fact that his earthly people had disobeyed him and had been taken into captivity, God made a way for them to return to the land in preparation for the coming of the Messiah.
Or for that matter, Simon, for Christ to be born in Bethlehem.
Yes, you know,
that's the broad sweep.
Yes.
This is God's counsels worked out through his ways.
Yes.
And this was all in preparation for Messiah to be born in Bethlehem, and for the temple to be in Jerusalem and Israel and Judah to some extent back in their land.
Yeah.
As far as those that were left in Babylon, and I think Andrew related it to those who haven't left the established church and have come out, to those that gather to the Lord's name, we shouldn't despise them. There's a couple of verses that I'd just like to read. One in Mark chapter 9. And John speaking, he saw, "Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name. We forbade him, because he followed us not." Jesus said, "He that is not against us is on our part." And then in Matthew chapter 12, he says what we might say is the opposite. In Matthew 12, verse 30, "He that is not with me is against me. And he that gathereth not with me scattereth abroad." The first verses that we read in Mark, it's a question of me. They are not with us in our meeting, therefore we don't like them. But the Lord says, yes, we do. And then the second one in Matthew, it was speaking against the person of the Lord. And even though there may be those in Christendom today that will speak against the person of the work of the Lord Jesus, they are not the ones that we can have fellowship with or associate with.
Yeah, Cyrus did seem to have really some God-given perceptions, didn't he, about what would happen. You could say, well, he knew that some wouldn't go back. They would be too comfortable in Babylon or wherever they were in his empire, and so they wouldn't go back. But it seems to me that his understanding of what he was doing was a bit deeper than we might give credit for. And perhaps we can't explain it, but back in Isaiah chapter 40. We're not back in Isaiah. Moving on to Isaiah. But of course, this was a prophecy that Isaiah gave well before these events. In chapter 44, verses 27 and 28, that God says of Cyrus, "He is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid." One even wonders, I think it's suggested by one writer, I forget who it was, that he may even have heard of this prophecy and realized a little bit about the significance of it when he made his declaration that we have at the beginning of this chapter. But certainly he does encourage them to take advantage of the opportunity. And I just wanted to emphasize in verse 5 that it's good when those who seem to be in a position of responsibility among God's people, they give a lead. And although it's a very individual matter, as Andrew said, it does seem to me that these chiefs of the fathers did do that.
The remarkable thing is that Cyrus was mentioned by name.
Yes, that's right.
Of hundred years beforehand, certainly before he was born.
Yeah.
So it just shows God's sovereignty.
It would also have been a great encouragement to this remnant. In verse 1, we not only have reference to Cyrus, who the remnant would instantly think of Isaiah, but mention of Jeremiah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
70 years before Jeremiah had said this, that time had come. 200 years or thereabouts before Isaiah had said this, the time had come. God, or the remnant, would know God had foreseen these days and had told them of them in advance. So for this remnant that were stirred up now, what an encouragement. They weren't going back, if you like, going to an unknown condition like Abraham was. Arise up and go to a place you don't know. They were in a very similar position. Rise up and go to the city. Most of them wouldn't have seen it. You know, some did later on when they laid it. Some of the old men wept. So there were some who had seen it, but most wouldn't have. But they could be encouraged by this fact that God had already spoken of these things in his word. And this is encouragement for us. We think, well, our day, we are very small. Yes, but God has already told us about these things in advance and provided us with everything we need for us to answer for him in the day in which we live, a day of great weakness, undoubtedly. But God knew this, and God has provided everything we need. So there's a great encouragement for any remnant going back to know that God has already foreseen these days and written about them in advance.
Yeah. Just to go back to the point of those who remained, of course, one notable person who remained was Daniel, because it says at the beginning of chapter 10 of Daniel, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel. And when we look at our chapter, it says, now in the first year of Cyrus, verse 1. I know we're still hovering around the beginning of the chapter, but now in the first year of Cyrus. So Daniel was still there when people went back to Judah, and he didn't go back. We know that. But he had already foreseen what would happen in chapter 9, where his prophecy speaks of the fact that the city would be restored. That's his vision of the 70 weeks. So we do have to be careful about being critical of those who didn't return, because Daniel was among them, and I'm sure others were among them too. Even Nehemiah later on in the history, although he may not have been around exactly at this particular point in time, but he was still in Persia, and he didn't immediately, as soon as he was a certain age, go out to Judah. He only went there when he had an opportunity to do so on hearing the poor state of the people in the land. But he was very interested in how they were getting on. So that is an added those are two added reasons why we shouldn't be too critical of those who didn't actually go to Jerusalem.
I don't think any of us would criticize Daniel for staying in the land. The chances are he was 90. Perhaps yes. He could have been 85, 80 to 90.
Yeah.
And when I'm that age, and I'm sure it applies to you, Simon, we wouldn't want to walk about 800 miles across the mountains to go to Jerusalem.
No.
I'm sure that Daniel prayed in Babylon for them. And that's what we can do. If we can't go, we can pray for them.
Yeah.
Rusty's mentioned two New Testament examples, perhaps there's some Old Testament examples we can have as well. Abraham and Lot. Lot went into the city, but Abraham was continually interested in the well-being of Lot, prayed for him, interceded for him. The fact that he was separated from him and went away into the city, lost that inheritance, all his wealth, it didn't change the way Abraham felt for Lot.
No.
We can also think of the time is in Numbers 10 or 11, I think, where the people despised the manna and the Moses came out, but two of the prophets remained in the camp prophesying. And Joshua came to Moses and said, well, stop them. But Moses said, I would all, welcoming the fact they're prophesying, they would all God's people were like this. The fact that they were not doing what Moses had done, Moses was more than happy that these people were serving in that place. And lastly, perhaps a negative example, Elijah.
Yes.
Only I am left.
Yes.
Well, he knew there were others. He knew Obadiah. And in fact, I think somebody remarked about this in ministry a while ago, and it stuck with me. I think Elijah is the only Old Testament saint in the New Testament of whom something bad is said. In that, I think it's in Romans 9, 10, 11, somewhere there.
Yeah.
Where this attitude, only I am left. No, there were 7,000 that hadn't bowed the knee to Baal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the fact it's singled out in this way. It's a very good example for us of how not to act. We shouldn't despise those who were not acting as we are. Elijah had separated, had to suffer a lot. And here was this man, as far as he was concerned, not doing anything. But he had done quite a bit. And he'd even told Elijah this. But Elijah didn't value it. And he's criticized for it, this attitude. So there are many examples in the Word as to how we ought to value one another, wherever we are. We should always seek to be for the blessing of all. And we shouldn't, we're not here to judge one another.
No.
We all have to answer to God. I have to answer to God for myself, not for anyone else. And so we need to learn these lessons. And this is another section where we learn the positive way the remnant valued those who remained.
In this chapter, really, we see them working together, don't we? Because the ones that stay behind, they're told to give gifts to help those who go. So in some ways, the picture is a little bit skewed as far as that's concerned. But we know that when the judgment came upon Jerusalem, there were those that said, this will never happen to us. We need to stay in Jerusalem. They were told to go out to go to Babylon. They were told to accept God's judgment and then to build houses and to prosper in the land where God had sent them for this 70 years. And obviously many of them did do that. Not a great number, but and here they are prospering. I mean, we know Daniel had a good job. But the question is, the 70 years is now past. What are we going to do? We've got our houses and our lands and our families, and here this exercise about going back to Jerusalem. Do we stay or do we go? And that was a decision they had to make. Obviously some were keen to go, others were, well, we'll help them, but we're not ready to go ourselves. And perhaps that just is a picture to us or a challenge to us as to what our real commitment is to the things of God and to what God wants. It's so easy to have so many other influences on us which would tend to colour our thinking and our decisions.
Well, certainly we see in Ezra and Nehemiah the potential there is if we do do respond to the movement of the Spirit that God gives us. because obviously he doesn't give it for no purpose. He gives it so that his will might be fulfilled. We might enter fully into his mind. We've already mentioned the fact that the people went back to Judah because he wanted his people to be there when the Messiah came back. Okay, when the Messiah came. So we do see in these books positive aspects that result from taking a step of faith like these people did. Whereas in contrast, we see in the book of Esther that those who remained were much reduced, I think we would have to say, in their ability to enjoy the things of God. But the sad thing is that we do see very quickly in both Ezra and Nehemiah a falling away of commitment on the part of those who did make the move. So I think this is an indication that we will only enter into blessing from taking a step like this if we keep close to the Lord and his mind and will. Just because we've taken a step of faith according to the scriptures doesn't mean that we're guaranteed always to be in the good of it and to really enjoy God's blessing in it. And I think that's what we're going to find in both Ezra and Nehemiah.
So it's a bit like the 2.5 tribes that stayed on the other side of Jordan.
Yes, yes.
You know, they came across and helped the armies came across.
Yes.
But then they went back and stayed in the on the other side, didn't they?
Yeah. They were the first ones to experience the incursions of Israel's enemies before either of the captivities of Assyria or Babylon.
Although they couldn't worship being away from Jerusalem, the framework, the national structure was retained. And yes. As we go further, we'll see that they could show their link with Israel through their genealogy. You know,
yes,
they,
that's right, yes.
Prove. But we see it, I think, in verse 5. Rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin. So there was an element of leadership and direction through these elders, the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, with the spiritual element, shall we say, or with the priestly element who would direct the worship, and the priests and the Levites. So while they're away from their earthly center, which was Jerusalem, Daniel prayed with his windows open towards Jerusalem. Mm. While they were away from it, and while the priests could not function sacrificially and bring in offerings and so on, the structure with the priests and the Levites was still there. And once they transferred, of course, in this book, it's to do with the temple. And indeed, we find that they begin with the altar, whereas in Nehemiah, it's the building of the wall. But I'm just trying to show that there were elements there that God...
We can't hear you, Andrew. I can't. Yeah.
God could use in the leadership and in the spiritual element.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
You know, I'm just saying the priests and the Levites, with all those whose spirit was moved. So again, it comes back to that which is internal.
If these people had gone back because they wanted to, it originated with them, they would have something to boast in. Mm. But they went back because God stirred them up.
Yeah.
And that's something which is needed for a remnant to maintain that place of dependence.
Mm.
Everything is of grace. Anything we have is all of grace. And again, that's something we need to remember. The origin of the work, whether it was stirring up Cyrus to permit them to go back or to permit any of those who wanted to go back, everything we can trace back to God.
It's very interesting that we get this mentioned on the Cyrus Cylinder that is in the British Museum, which records facts very similar to what we have here.
Mm.
Although it seems to be referring to other gods as well. But
yeah, so I think it's often said that this is nothing special. Cyrus did this for all the peoples that he became king over as a result of the what the Babylonians had done. In particular, they had this policy of taking people captive, and obviously Cyrus or the Persians had a different view of things and were quite happy for these peoples to go back to their lands as long as they followed the interests of the overall empire. But I think we can be fairly sure that this was a very special aspect. In this case, it does seem from the scriptures that Cyrus had a particular insight into the fact that it was the will of God that this should happen in the case of the Jews.
Would that be illustrated in the fact that he brought forth the vessels of the house of the Lord?
Yeah, I think so.
Evidently, he knew the significance of them better than Belshazzar, or perhaps because of Belshazzar.
Yeah.
And the history is given here, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth, and those, as well as various other things of value, are restored onto them. But I think it is significant that he brought the vessels out of the house. These sacred vessels were given back. And he numbered them, and he numbered all these other things. It's a very precise procedure. William Rogers, who was a Puritan in the 1500s, was riding along with an Anglican one day, and eventually the Anglican said to him, I like your company very much, but you people are too precise. And he replied, oh, sir, we serve a precise God. Mm. And we can see that even in the way in which these things are catalogued or noted.
Yeah.
The way that these things were preserved shows that God was watching over them. I mean, gone from Babylonians to the Persians, and they knew where they were. And even, you know, small details, you think, oh, they're gold, they just melt them down and use them for their own ends. But God watched over them, even all those years. And give thanks that he does take care of all the little details of that which concerns his interests.
Yes, that's why it was such a serious thing for Belshazzar to do what he did with the cups and other items that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple. It's remarkable that he gets this vision of the hand writing on the plaster of the wall, signifying that his kingdom was to fall that very night. But one can see the complete justness of that by the very fact that he had taken it upon himself to actually arrange for these cups and things to be brought out of the temple so that his princes could enjoy drinking from them at the same time as invocating their idols. This was this is the other side of what you've been drawing attention to. If God puts great value on these things and wants them maintained and kept and preserved, then he's going to take action against those who oppose him in the way in which Belshazzar did. Completely different attitude to that of Cyrus.
As far as the numbers are concerned, they don't add up. So if we add up the numbers in verse 9, they come to 2,499. In verse 11, there seems to be 5,400.
Hmm. And the answer to that difference is?
I can only think there were a lot smaller items.
Yes. Yeah.
That are not listed.
Well, some of these items in verse 10, in verse 9 and 10, are very significant items. I think there's a reference back to the word for charges, which I can't find at the moment, which suggests that they're the same as, or in another Old Testament book. When you try and work out the weight of them from that book, because they're given the weight of in shekels, you discover that they must have been very, very magnificent pieces of silver and gold. So that there may well have been other less significant pieces that are not mentioned here.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, they strengthened their hands with precious things. And that was the name that Mr. Hughes and George Davidson gave to their little magazine, Precious Things, continued by Sidney Thurston. And there's never a day in which we need to strengthen our hands with precious things than today. And we won't get it, generally speaking, from social media. We won't find it in the world. And we need to strengthen our hands with precious things. What a wonderful, precious revelation we have, particularly when we come into the New Testament, of all the precious things of Christ that are available for our soul, for our spirits, and to strengthen us in our walk and in our testimony.
But I suppose we could also say from verse 6 that though there were things that there were going to need in order to equip the temple when it was rebuilt, vessels of silver with gold, there are also beasts and goods, which I suppose are practical supplies, the animals needed to pull the carts, which will carry these things. So it indicates that there was some value placed on the gold and silver, but also a realization that the ones going back needed practical help as well.
When Israel had been taken out of the land, when Israel were in the land and the temple was functioning, there were certain things that they did, certain things they could see. Now they'd been taken away and they'd come back. They were not free to change anything. No. There were some differences. They no longer had the visible presence of God. This Ezekiel had prophesied to the captives, the glory of God departing, that never returned, at least hasn't yet returned. It will, but not yet. They no longer had a priest, we'll see in the next chapter, who was able to discern the mind of God in the way that the high priest used to. But everything else, they had to do the same. They had to go to the same place. They couldn't worship in Babylon. We've seen this, and it's quite remarkable. The end of verse 3 or 2, house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah, the end of verse 3, which is in Jerusalem, the end of verse 4, the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, same verse 5, Jerusalem. This was the only place they could go. The temple there, which they were going to rebuild, was the only place they could worship. These vessels that they were given now by Cyrus were the only vessels they could use. They couldn't change anything. The priests that were going back were the same line of priests. We see again in the next chapter.
Yeah.
Those who couldn't prove their genealogy to be a priest according to the line of Aaron, they were put out. Not that they would say, you're not priest, but we can't tell. We can't prove it. They were not free to change anything. And it's another feature of a remnant. They're not free to change any aspect of worship. They may not have the visible display of glory. And we spoke about this last week in regard to the era of Pentecostalism, desiring these things. A remnant never has these things. But the remnant is not free to change any aspect of worship. And so the vessels that were committed now to Zerubbabel, or here called Sheshbazzar, he had to take back and he had to account for them when he got there. He had to hand them over, and that count was made before and account after. And he was responsible to bring these back because these were the only vessels that could be used in the temple, none others. They were not free to change any aspect of the worship. And again, that's vital for a remnant. A remnant can only gather on the same ground, the scriptural ground that God instituted at the start, and worship in the same way. It might only be a remnant than now there, not the whole nation. But that does not affect in any way the way they gather, the way they meet, the way they worship. They cannot change it. And I suppose one lesson we learned from the fact these items were given to Sheshbazzar and he had to account from the other end shows the responsibility that this remnant had to answer to that point.
One thing they didn't seem to have, or it's more than one thing actually, in referring to the vessels of silver with gold, it strikes me that there's no reference here to the ark or the mercy seat or the table or the altar of incense or the candlestick. Would I be right in saying that these things were no longer available to them? Don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but it is remarkable that history says of two of the Roman generals of the intertestamentary period between Malachi and Matthew, who actually went as far as going into the Holy of Holies in the temple, were shocked to discover that there was nothing in the Holy of Holies. There was no ark. And of course, it was completely alien to them to think that the place where the God of the Israelites dwelt was in fact completely empty. But I don't know if anybody's got any, can shine any light on this, but I don't think the ark was one of the things that returned with them. Or perhaps I'm wrong.
In chapter 3, it says they built the altar, so they probably didn't have anything with them.
Yes, they were able to erect the altar. That seems to be the main thing that they came back to do, doesn't it? I assume that's the altar of burnt offering. Well, I think it was, because in chapter 3, verse 2, it says to offer burnt offerings thereon. But of course, the ark was the throne of God. The mercy seat was God's seat. You've already said, Andrew, that the presence of God wasn't there in the way it had been in the old temple, in the first temple, or the temple that Solomon built, to be more exact. Because Ezekiel saw it depart, and we have no record that it returned at this time. And I think you're right to say that it won't return until the Lord Jesus comes back to his people.
Well, we don't have all the Pentecostal gifts today, do we?
No.
We don't have the powers of the world to come. No. We don't have the signs and wonders which were wrought by the apostles. But we have those gifts for edification that would remain, and for evangelization also, the necessary gifts.
Yeah.
And there may have been those things which were missing, but they had what was necessary to commence a divine service.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think we should be thankful that God, to use a verse slightly out of context, has given us all things that pertain unto life and godliness in the manner of spiritual worship that can be carried on today, even though we do not have some of these more fanciful and sensational gifts such as healing or tongues.
When the ark was lost in Eli's day, although it was returned to Israel, it never found its place in the tabernacle. It wasn't set in the right place again until Solomon's day. David brought it into the city, but I don't think it was really centered until then. And if they had the ark or not, I don't think we can say for certain, but it wouldn't really be appropriate to mention it for the reasons we've already spoken about.
Yeah.
It's not consistent with this truth that we are looking at, the spiritual teaching, in that what was lost, God doesn't restore. He will be with his people still, but that outward display was not the case in this day. And it's the same, we might say, for our day of breakdown. Mm-hmm. We don't have that same display of God's glory, but nevertheless, we still have his presence. He is with us, but not doesn't demonstrate it in the same way.
We do know that the laver was broken up, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right.
The laver was broken, so obviously some of the things were destroyed.
Mm.
That was not like a laver like the tabernacle. It was a rather grand affair that Solomon built.
Yeah.
Far too heavy to take us in one piece.
Mm.
But we do know that there's no ark in the millennial temple.
Mm.
As Jeremiah tells us, that they shouldn't think about the ark anymore because the Lord will be there.
Mm.
So today, many people are looking for the ark.
Yes.
but there won't be one.
It's just one thing you mentioned there, Andrew. This man Zerubbabel is the same man called Sheshbazzar, I think. I think that's generally thought to be the case, because there are so many times when they seem to mean the same person. The chief person among the returning captives. Zerubbabel is in the genealogy, is he not, in Matthew chapter 1, suggesting he was of the royal line. Sheshbazzar would seem to be the name he was given by the Persian king, a bit like Daniel had two names, Daniel had two names, and so did his companions. But I think we can be fairly sure it's one and the same man.
This man, Sheshbazzar, is, if he is Zerubbabel, which I think he is not now the king.
No.
Though he was of the royal line, he is the prince of Judah. He's subordinate to Cyrus, the Persian king. There will not be a king in Israel until Messiah, until Christ comes.
Yes.
Again, what is lost in responsibility? God doesn't restore. He will bring out his own king, but no one of his line will be king till he comes.
No, that's right. I don't think there can be another king. Certainly not given in Matthew when the wise men came to Jerusalem. They said, "Where is he that is born king of the Jews?" There were a lot of so-called kings like Herod, but the one who did come and is king by rights was rejected, and God's not going to allow another king until he sets his true king in Zion, according to Psalm 110. But there will be those who seek to take his place, and of course we know one in particular as Antichrist, but that's another subject, and perhaps we've come to the end of our study. So I think we can begin again to probably at the beginning. What do you think, the beginning of chapter 2?
We just finished. Can I just have a suggestion that in that the problem with these numbers that Rusty mentioned,
yes,
there are also mentioned in verse 6 that the vessels that the people gave to them,
yes,
I wonder whether those vessels also added into the whole number,
yeah,
to make up the number required at the end of in verse 11. Just a small point,
the suggestion, yeah. Well, we know there's an explanation for everything that first appears to be a contradiction or not quite right, because it's God's word. Okay, if a brother would close in prayer, we'd appreciate that. Yeah.